Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by Fluke Hearing, finding ways to help people hear like nature intended, with 16 locations including Lansing, Jackson, Grand Rapids, and Ann Arbor. FlukeHearing.com.
Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. This is 90.5 WKAR. There was a pretty funny moment yesterday involving Tom Izzo and tomorrow night's game appearing on ESPN Radio. Tom pointed out that his son Steven has dutifully filled out his brackets, and he showed them to his dad, and Tom notices that he has not picked the winner of the MSU Duke game, and Tom asks why not, and young Steven replies that he really just doesn't know who to pick. And I take it he's saying this literally, the way this story is being retold on ESPN Radio. He was really flummoxed over who to pick, and Coach responds, "Well, Steven, you got to go with your head, not your heart. Go with your head, not your heart." And he shows him his brackets a few minutes later, and he's picked Duke. So how funny is that? Steven Mateen Izzo picking Duke over MSU tomorrow night. And to hear Tom tell the story was quite amusing. He got a real charge out of it. So tip off 9:45 tomorrow night at Indianapolis. We're happy to welcome to Current State Mid-Michigan's best-known mother-daughter political duo. Barb Byram was elected Ingham County Clerk last November after serving 6 years as 67th District Democratic State Rep, and she held other civic positions before that, and she owns a hardware store business in Charlotte. Her mother, Diane Byram, currently serves on the Michigan State University Board of Trustees and previously served as State Rep, State Senator, Ingham County Commissioner, and Chancellor of the Exchequer, if I remember correctly. Happy to welcome Diane and Barb Byram to Current State.
Thank you so much.
How are you?
We're doing great.
Doing well.
This is the first time you've ever done anything like this together? Am I right about that?
I don't think we've ever done an appearance together.
Not
like
on radio. Yeah. We don't know. Normally our appearances together are home around grandchildren at the dinner table.
Yeah. Well, it's more evidence the media has been asleep on the job. Pass up an opportunity like this. Barb, tell us about your first few months at your new job. What have you learned as Ingham County Clerk?
Well, serving as the county clerk has been a tremendous honor that I am able to serve in this capacity. I am amazed by the foot traffic that comes into the main Mason office as well as our Lansing branch office. You know, kindergarten roundups right around the corner, so a lot of parents are getting the birth certificates because schools do require a copy of a birth certificate. But most notably are the applications for concealed pistol licenses. They all come through the county clerk's office, and we're seeing easily 200-300 a month, and it's been a large volume. In addition to the marriage ceremonies that I've been doing, I've married, I think, 35 couples now.
Now, did your predecessor do that? Did Mike Bryanton marry people?
I think he did earlier in his term, but towards the end of the term, I'm given the impression that he was not as much.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, the marriage ceremonies, the death certificates, DD-214s, we just are busy. And I'm looking forward to updating some of the technology in the office and having a more user-friendly website and that sort of thing. So,
but what have you learned? How has the job been different maybe than what you anticipated?
You know, I learned that our county clerk's office holds very serious records. And some of those records are private and some of those are public. And it is amazing how far back those records go with the marriage license, the death certificates, and the birth certificates. And it's amazing watching how those certificates have evolved over the years. It's just a fascinating office.
It's an interesting history lesson. Is
it
that what you're saying?
It certainly is.
And you get to work out of the county courthouse, which is a beautiful historical place, too, right? And you continue to help run a hardware store, raise some kids, raise a husband.
Yeah, raising the husband, yes.
Sell Mary Kay.
Yeah.
The whole nine yards.
Yeah, the whole nine yards.
And Diane, If I'm not mistaken, it's already been over 3 years for you on the MSU Board of Trustees.
That's correct.
09, mm-hmm. right? Same question. What's your couple of top priorities? Barb got into her, what's at the top
right.
as county clerk. What are your couple of top priorities as an MSU trustee?
Well, I care passionately about students and making sure that they have a robust experience as during their career at Michigan State University. Some areas that I'm particularly interested in would be agriculture, the College of Agriculture. That's my alma mater. And, you know, we've struggled with a dean replacement for Dean Armstrong. We now have Dean Poston in place. So seeing that college build out and be robust again is something that I'm very interested and passionate about.
A personal background with that then.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And with you, Barb, right? Yeah. I mean, agribusiness degree from Michigan State,
right,
if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
Yeah.
And my degree was eliminated. I was a public affairs management degree, Ag Econ, and that kind of went away.
Oh, yeah.
I was in the first graduating class, and then I was a trustee when the major was eliminated.
I can relate to that because I started out as a television and radio major at Michigan State, and that went by the wayside a long time ago.
Right.
What do you, Diane, what do you personally anticipate regarding state funding? Will it be going up again? And if so, when?
We have had more than a decade of flat or a cut in state support for higher education. Even 3 years ago, it was a hard 15% cut. And it's been difficult in lean times at the university, and I think you can see that reflected not only in the cost of tuition, because there is a direct correlation between state appropriation and tuition costs, and just some of the fee structures. So Michigan State has had to become quite lean by still having a good value for students, because our students are middle-class kids,
mm-hmm.
and they're middle-class kids from Michigan. So I hope that we have a future where we have increased state support through funding for higher education. It looks like this year it's going to be an increase, you know, 1-2%.
Right.
Clearly not inflation, but at least it's not a negative number. So I'm just hoping, because Michigan's future is connected to the educational level of our citizens. And a democracy thrives when you have solid, educated citizens, and the economy thrives when you have an educated citizenry. And higher education plays a role in that.
We're talking with Diane and Barb Byram here on Current State. This is interesting, though. You don't want to wish Republicans too much success, but by the same token, if Michigan continues to rebound, doesn't that stand to improve the funding picture for Michigan State University?
Well, I would hope, as the state budget coffers have more money in them, that some of that will go into higher education.
Okay. Barb, a couple of days ago, you opined in the Free Press against Secretary of State Ruth Johnson's apparent support of a revised Electoral College framework here in Michigan. Ms. Johnson advocates moving away from the state's winner-take-all model and toward a hybrid approach of assigning the state's 16 electoral votes. This combined approach, which is being batted around in the legislature, we don't have a final plan yet, but this combined approach would presumably include the popular vote, but would also assign votes according to vote tallies in individual congressional districts. You have real concerns about this plan. How do you think this will take shape?
Yeah, I have major concerns about this plan. In fact, when this when similar legislation was introduced last term by Representative Lund, I opposed it then. I've authored a couple op-eds, the most notably Free Press op-ed that I authored earlier this week. Because what this is, I mean, as our chief elections officer, the Secretary of State should not, she should be ashamed of herself for supporting such a partisan election rigging scheme.
Explain to our listeners how exactly this boils down to being so partisan, in your view.
In my view, so it's so partisan because although the state has gone for the Democratic presidential nominee for the past 8 election cycles, I believe it is, the Republicans are very upset about that, and therefore they're changing the equation and changing the way we do our electoral votes in our state to then go for the Republican nominee. If you look at the congressional districts and how they were drawn, and you look at because they were drawn by the Republicans with gerrymandering, quite frankly, then it would lead one to conclude that the Republican nominee would get the electoral votes from the state of Michigan. This is changing the game in the middle, changing the rules in the middle of the game. And there is no place for election rigging in our state. Quite frankly, it's my job to protect the democratic process in our elections as a county clerk. And I am going to continue to let people know about this new election rigging scheme that is out there in hopes that the veil will be shed and people will see what this truly is.
This does get back to the fact that the Republicans did so well in 2011, mm-hmm. and we had a new census to work with. So they had a majority of right. people at the table to redraw these districts. How is the public to make sense of this district drawing dynamic that goes on every 10 years?
The redistricting process in our state needs a very serious attention, because quite frankly, it is drawn by whichever party is in power.
Right.
Which has, you know, was the Republicans last year and was the Republicans 10 years ago.
And every time a new census comes out, it's time to do it all over
right,
again. So
right.
whoever is in power really has an advantage.
Right. We need a nonpartisan approach at drawing our districts.
I think this reapportionment question and reapportionment reform is the single most important issue facing our state. It's that serious.
Really?
And it should be done in a way that does not advantage one political party over the other. Michigan is a very competitive state. We're not really a red state or a blue state. And if you have competitive elections, you are going to get the best candidates with the best ideas, and they're going to represent the majority of the people. What you have now, because of the extreme gerrymandering that has gone on, is that you have a very small minority of individuals that participate in a Republican primary election controlling the political agenda of Michigan, and it is that simple. And when you get a minority of a subgroup controlling what goes on in the laws that are passed in this state, that's dangerous for democracy with a small d.
In realistic political terms, does a plan like this have legs to make it all the way to the governor and be signed into law?
Yes, it does.
You think so?
You have one party controlling the legislative process, the executive branch, and the courts.
But what about Governor Snyder, though? Do you think he's a slam dunk supporter of this? After the brouhaha of right to work, this strikes me as potentially something that he may not get behind.
I think,
and Senator Richardville as well.
I would hope that would be the case, but I would not hang all my hopes on that, because I have seen Governor Snyder take some positions that, frankly, I was amazed at.
Mm-hmm.
And because he now is running for re-election. And although he ran as a non-politician, somebody from the business sector, once he got into office and made the decision that he was running for re-election, he became a political person.
Yeah.
And he has made decisions based on, am I going to have a primary? How can I solidify my reelection? And once you start making decisions based on politics, he really left that world from where he started from. So I think it's very possible that he could embrace this.
Does this support by Secretary Johnson lead either of you to consider a run for Secretary of State?
Well, I'm focused on the Ingham County Clerk's office. I have a few elections coming up just this year still, and I'm focused on making sure those elections are run as smoothly as possible and maintaining the records of Ingham County.
Okay.
I can say, first of all, as a mother, I'm very proud of Barb stepping up and speaking out and lending her voice so that there's a public debate on this, because it seems to really be pretty silent from the Democratic side of the aisle. Me personally, I love being a trustee, and I love the private sector and being a grandma, so I'm not running for anything.
Last May, around 130,000 electronic records from the county mm-hmm. clerk's office vanished due to what then County Commissioner Mark Grebner referred to as, quote, an impressive series of screw-ups. Tex removed a server thought to contain expired data. Many files needed by your predecessor, Mike Bryanton, were indeed active files. We then learned a backup duplication system failed. Some expensive corrections were made. Barb, where does the e-data situation stand right now?
So we have the physical files. The physical documents. I have been going through and doing quite a bit of quality checks, and I'm not satisfied with certain portions of some records.
We want to make clear, too, that you always had the physical files.
Yes. Okay. Oh, absolutely. We always had the physical
the
files.
The e-files vanished, but the physical files were always there.
Right.
But it created all kinds of chaos.
Yeah. I mean, prior to the third party scanning them back into the system, a parent or guardian would come in for a birth certificate and perhaps have to wait days as opposed to minutes, which is now the case. Now you're back to minutes. But the third party that scanned in some of those records, some of the records are they were scanned in poorly. Some documents were not brought back in electronically. So we're doing quality checks, and we have worked with a third-party vendor. We're going to be getting some other records scanned back in because the quality was certainly not satisfactory. And then I'm also keeping the new IT director, MIS director, very close because I am charged with maintaining all of those records.
Who is that?
That is Mr. Ashton, and I am keeping him very close. We met yesterday. We're meeting at least twice, at least biweekly.
First name?
Mike.
Mike Ashton.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good.
I always call him Mr., so I think it's Mike. Yeah. So I keep him very close, and we're going to be doing a trial of our backup system because one of the issues with the backup was that they were using tape backups, which we haven't used tape backups in years.
Yeah.
So we are doing quality checks and making sure that something like this does not happen again.
How much did this end up costing? Is that clear?
That is not clear. That was paid for out of last year's budget, and I think a lot of it was absorbed by the MIS department.
Okay. But was that an unbudgeted cost? That was above and beyond what had already been budgeted for last year.
That is my understanding, yes.
Okay. Overall, what kind of shape was the clerk's office in when you moved in?
You know, anytime you take over a new office, there are certain changes you want to make. And with the election side, we have made quite a bit of changes just to be more forthcoming with information, utilizing technology. We had an election in East Lansing Public Schools. I'm not satisfied with our website as it is currently, so I was tweeting out and posting on Facebook election results so that people could have them quickly. There are changes that need to be had, but a lot of those changes cost money. So I am trying to figure out how, within my budget, I may update the website or, quite honestly, completely overhaul the website and make it more user-friendly so that truly people can go to this website and request true electronic requests of records. Because right now, it's not a true electronic request. It's printing a document off a website to fax it or scan it back in and email it. I want to offer true electronic communications to the citizens of Bingham County.
I happen to know a few reporters who would not quarrel with an updated website when it comes to election results on election night,
right.
too,
yes.
to tell
yes.
you the truth. Your party has a new leader here in Michigan, Lon Johnson. Diane, was it time for a new person at the top?
I was a Mark Brewer supporter.
Okay.
And I continue to think extremely favorably and very high of Mark Brewer, who gave a lot of years to the party. So I was not a Lon Johnson supporter at the convention, but I do accept that Lon Johnson is our party chair, and I am committed to work with him to make sure that we have a strong state party and that we elect Democrats up and down our ticket.
How should we interpret the other voices in your party who insisted it was time for a change? How should we process that?
Well, the party will move on, and I think we'll move on. I don't think it's going to be anything that is going to be long lasting and handicap the party. I was hoping that we would come up with some sort of a hybrid, and that we could have Lon Johnson have the public role, but we could continue to have the talents of Mark Brewer, because he is a very talented individual who's given his life and his entire career to the state Democratic Party. That didn't happen, so we'll move on, we'll regroup. It's not going to be that we're going to pick up our toys and go home. We're all going to join forces, and we're going to regroup and work with a new party chair.
We're talking with Diane and Barb Byram here on Current State on WKAR. A few weeks ago, the Free Press's Brian Dickerson wrote, quote, a real leadership void confronting Democrats as they anticipate the 2014 election. Is there a leadership challenge for your party, Barb?
You know, I look forward to watching this all unfold. We have some amazing candidates who have been spoken of and those that haven't been spoken of yet. And I look forward to seeing who is asked to run for these higher offices, and I look forward to supporting them.
Diane?
Since I spent my time in the Michigan legislature, when I walked out of there, I had a real commitment to make sure that I did everything I could do to nurture and help grow the next generation of elected officials on the Democratic side of the aisle and build state party. So I've spent a lot of my time doing that, and I do think we're in a transition as a party. We will have a ticket. And we will have a strong U.S. Senate candidate, and we will have a gubernatorial candidate, statewide offices, and then House and Senate candidates. I think we're still figuring out who those individuals are going to be. And at this point in time, I don't want to tip my hand as to where my preferences are. But we will have a ticket, and I think Democrats will be very competitive because we will give a clear alternative to the Republicans who are currently in charge today. And it's going to be economic issues about the Republicans do not represent the middle class citizens of Michigan, whether it's on education, it's on tax laws and you know, the corporate taxes versus individual taxes, on the environment. They don't represent where Michigan's electorate is today.
We had Congressman Gary Peters on the show the week before last. His name is probably mentioned more often to replace Carl Levin in the Senate. Do you like Gary Peters?
I like Gary Peters a lot. I served with Gary Peters for 8 years in the state Senate, and so we sat by each other for 8 years, and I've seen Gary work.
Is he on your short list?
He would be on my short list, absolutely.
Okay. Obviously, a lot may hinge on the candidate, but how much overall effort do you think it will take a Democrat, take for a Democrat to oust Rick Snyder next year? How vulnerable is he, and how strong of a candidate do you think you need to find?
I think Snyder is vulnerable to the extent, as I said, I believe that they're out of step with the majority of Michigan's voting citizenry. Mm-hmm. And I do think that Democrats can present a clear alternative. Now, Rick Snyder is going to have the baggage of what's going on in the Michigan legislature. They will not expand Medicaid. That's, or at least currently, that's going to have a major impact on the health care sector of this state through economic impact and jobs.
We're just about out of time. I have to ask you about Mayor Virge Brunero. Would he be on your short list?
I like Virge, but I think Virge said it best that he's going to be mayor of Lansing, and that's where his focus is, and I would support that.
Is it important not to go with Virge because of his loss 3 years ago? I mean, is it important to get a different person at the top of the ballot?
I think we will have a different person at the top of the ballot, and I think Virge will be supportive of whoever that person is.
Okay. Been a real pleasure to have both of you. It's just flown. Barb Byram is the clerk of Ingham County. Diane Byram is an MSU trustee. We'll have you back, okay?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Remembering 1968, do you remember the Tigers? Of course, but a lot else happened in the summer of 68. We'll talk with an author of a book all about it, and Lansing's approach, Lansing's reenactment of the Stations of the Cross. That and flutist James Galway, all coming up on Current State. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks a lot for joining us. I'm reading on tweets here today to the effect that Susan Demos of MLive is apparently going to be ending her column. It's not really clear to me why or what the circumstances are, but it appears pretty clear that Susan's column on MLive is coming to an end for whatever reason. 1968 was a tumultuous year with riots, the Vietnam War, and the King and Kennedy assassinations. In Michigan, the success of the World Series champion Detroit Tigers helped people get through that difficult time. Tim Wendell chronicles the relationship between the news of the world and the baseball heroes of that year in Summer of 68, the season that changed baseball and America forever. He spoke with Current State Scott Pohl.
We kind of separate things in the different categories. It's like we almost get uneasy if things are not in a category. And so we've got politics over there and sports over there and culture and music, et cetera. And what guys like, say, Mickey Lolich, you know, ex-Tiger great, another one, Willie Horton, Gates Brown, started to emphasize with me was they said, you know, things weren't that separate then. Ball players were much more a part of the community. I mean, the money wasn't as big. And as probably Gates Brown pointed out the best, he said, 1968 was so tumultuous, it was so horrific in many ways that you were never, in a sense, safe from it. Something was going to get you. And it may have been, you know, the King assassination, the Kennedy assassination. Something was going to break your heart.
Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee.
Ladies and gentlemen, Kennedy has been shot. They think Kennedy has been shot. It appeared to be gunshot. Seems like Robert Kennedy has been shot.
The ball players were no different than the rest of us, and they were struggling to kind of carry on. And in a sense, hearing their stories, like Willie Horton going down to, you know, single-handedly trying to stop the riots in Detroit, Mickey Lolich being part of a National Guard unit that's called out to patrol downtown Detroit when the riots really pick up, it started to underscore to me that they were a part of this too. And I think a lot of their reactions and the way they coped were very human, and in many ways resonate today, and I think lessons can be learned from that.
For the people of Detroit and Michigan, the baseball season offered an oasis from all that, including the city's riots in 1967.
Very much so, and I don't think, Scott, any team was under as much pressure as the 68 season began than the Detroit Tigers. I mean, the city of Detroit had suffered the worst riots arguably since the Civil War the season before.
4 days of rioting, looting, and arson rocked the city of Detroit in the worst outbreak of urban racial violence this year. Entire blocks of homes become infernos. At least 36 are killed, more than 2,000 injured, and damage topped the $500 million mark.
City officials, police officials had pretty much told the team, which had come up one game short of winning the pennant in 1967, you know, it'd be great if you guys finally won. Not only would it be fun to have you win, but it might save the city, too. So you talk about some very, you know, high-pressure stakes. And I think in a lot of ways they rose to the occasion. This was a team that had a great many Michigan-born players. They knew what was at stake in terms of, you know, what it could mean to the city and such if they won. And they, as I said, rose to the occasion. One of the things I loved about this team is I think it's 23 or 24 times they rallied in the seventh inning or later to win a ball game.
Swing, there's a long belt in the center field. Robinson going back, way back. He can't get this one. It's passing to the fence. Here comes Stanley. He scores. Rounding third is Freehand. He scores. Willie Horton rounding third, and he holds up as the throw comes into Fernandez. It's a long triple for Willie, and the Tigers have the lead. 6-5, favor Detroit.
Some of the old police officials I spoke with pointed out that in 67, in Detroit, if you saw a number of people gathered on a street corner or something, that was probably trouble. In 1968, they soon learned that if you saw a bunch of people gathering, oh, they were might just be listening to the radio and Ernie Harwell calling the action, because the Tigers, even though they're behind, hey, they came back the night before, they might just do it again. And I think in that way, they really helped hold a city, in a sense, together. And one of the things that I really loved about Summer of 68 as I got into the research of it was I kept thinking something held us together that year. That was one of the worst years in our nation's history. And the more and more research I did and the more interviews I did with guys like the old Tigers, I came to the conclusion that, in a sense, sports helped hold us together.
Game 1 of the World Series featured the era's two most dominant pitchers, the game's last 30-game winner, Denny McClain of the Tigers, and the Cardinals hurler, Bob Gibson. Their matchup really reflected the times, didn't it?
Very much so. And I think both of these guys reacted, Scott, in very human, though markedly different ways to what was going on around them. Bob Gibson, the great St. Louis Cardinals staff ace, really didn't get off to the best of starts in 1968. He was overshadowed early on by Don Drysdale's scoreless inning streak. Over in the American League, Catfish Hunter pitched a perfect game. Louis Tiant was off to a great start. You know, it wasn't like Bob was stinking the place up, but he wasn't there in the forefront of great pitching performances early in 68. And as much as he will acknowledge it, King's assassination in April of that year really rocked him. He was a prominent African-American. Here he had the top civil rights leader gunned down in Memphis, so he was off his game a little bit. And then after Bobby Kennedy is shot, unfortunately, 2 months almost to the day at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles after King, somehow Gibson turns things around. He's got a great quote where he says something effective, when King was shot, I was distraught, sad, something like that. But when they shot Bobby Kennedy, I became infuriated. And somehow he was able to channel this passion, anger, almost disgust with what was going on around him into one of the most epic pitching performances of all time. He pitches his first shutout of the season in his first start after Kennedy's assassination in June. Goes on to pitch 13 shutouts in the season, an earned run average of 1.12. You know, for baseball fans, I don't think we're ever really going to see that again. And he pitched 28 complete games. And we make a big deal now when somebody has 9 or 10 complete games for a season. Complimented on the other side was Denny McClain. Denny McClain for the Tigers, I think, made a conscious choice, or maybe an unconscious choice. Things are going kind of south, and we're in this tumultuous time. Let's have some fun. And he was, I think, very much as much a celebrity athlete probably we've had since maybe Babe Ruth before, or maybe Dizzy Dean. And he decided, in a sense, he was going to enjoy himself and try to live life to the fullest. One of the great interview answers he gives about mid-season in 68 is somebody asks him, Denny, what's the real goal here? Is it to win the pennant that eluded the Tigers in 67, you know, finally win it? Is it to win 30 games? He was well on his way to being the first pitcher in decades to win 30 games in a season. And Denny kind of thinks about it and says, well, you know, those are kind of important, but I'd really like to be on the Ed Sullivan Show. In essence, you know, he played a Hammond organ. He was an accomplished musician. Along with what's going on with the riots in the streets, you're having, you know, certainly the riots in Chicago, and it's all coupled with what's going on at the baseball game, and oh, here comes the Summer Olympics from Mexico City, too, where Tommy Smith and John Carlos raise their fists in the air after being on the victory stand. And I took some delight, I must admit, Scott, in kind of bringing together what some people, at least at first blush, would go, boy, that's a pretty interesting collection of characters. And yet, I think for the most part it worked. And I'll tell you, one of the guys that I reached out a lot to in the closing days of writing Summer 68 was Tom Hayden, who had grown up in Royal Oak, Michigan, who most people remember as one of the guys who was part of the Chicago Seven at the riots outside the Democratic National Convention, who is the guy who goes on to marry Jane Fonda. But Tom was also a huge baseball fan and grew up playing against many of the guys who went on to play on the Tigers, like Bill Freehan and Jim Northrup and Mickey Stanley. And one of the things I love about baseball is it kind of brings us back in a strange way. And when I first started talking with Tom, I asked him kind of what he was doing and et cetera, and I was expecting some political things, and I knew he was still out in California. He'd been in the state assembly and such out there. And out of the blue, he starts going, yeah, I've gone back to playing baseball. I believe he was 73 now, and I'm playing in a Ponce de Leon league in Santa Monica and coaching high school guys, too. And I'm just going, there you go. I mean, there's the magic of the game, because it's somehow, after all these years, even if a guy like Tom Hayden can come back to baseball and be playing it, it has to say something about the game.
Tim Wendel, author of Summer of 68, The Season That Changed Baseball and America Forever. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure, Scott.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Oh, say, does that stop?
Tomorrow is Good Friday, the date 2,000 years ago on which Jesus of Nazareth was sentenced to death and crucified. For more than 30 years, volunteers here in Lansing have memorialized the events of that day with a live reenactment of the Passion. Actors will gather on the steps of the state capitol to recall Jesus' sentencing by the Roman governor Pontius Pilate. From there, a long procession will travel through the streets of Lansing to mark the Christian tradition of the Stations of the Cross. The route ends at Cristo Rey Community Center on High Street. Current State's Kevin Lavery spoke with the lead organizer of the event and the actor who will portray Jesus.
I met Jose Gallo between classes at Lansing Eastern High School, where he's finishing up his junior year. He's a member of Cristo Rey Catholic Church, which co-sponsors the live reenactment. Jose started off a few years ago playing a Roman soldier, but he's since paid his dues, and this year will be his second turn in the role of Jesus.
What does it feel like when you portray Jesus? And give me a sense of what people will see and experience on Friday.
Well, what I feel is, you know, I do it just to thank God for everything. So while I'm actually walking in each step on each station that Jesus Christ has went through, I thank him for everything and every situation of life that he's done. And then I ask him for help, for guidance in life, period. But people, I would say, expect to see is, you know, a good performance. I've been actually training for this for quite a while now. And a lot of people told me that they feel like it's an actual act. Like, they feel like it's not just like someone just doing it to do it, but I'm actually into it.
Do people actually strike you? And are you wearing the purple cloak, the crown of thorns?
Yeah, I wear the crown of thorns and the purple cloak. And I also, I tell them to actually hit me, because I want it as if I'm actually feeling the pain. But they take it easy on me, of course. So, but they do hit me to the point where I can like have that scream, that actual sense of that I'm feeling hurt.
Have you ever actually seen the movie by Mel Gibson, The Passion of the Christ?
Oh, yes. The first time I actually saw the movie was when I was 7, and I watch it every now and then. I still feel emotional about it, like I cry every time. I watch it and watch each step and how Jesus' face reactions are and his emotions are throughout the play, for I can maybe use those as an experience towards the play, for I can do a better job as an actor.
Jose, is there maybe one moment while you're doing this that really tends to be more significant perhaps personally to you than the others? Is there one high point that has real meaning for you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the real meaning to me about this is, you know, God has given up his only son on the cross to die for me. And, you know, I'm grateful every day, every day that I'm grateful just to have life. So I feel like this is me paying back to him.
Jose Gallo is a student at Lansing Eastern High School, and this is his second year in a row performing as Jesus Christ in the Stations of the Cross for Good Friday. Jose, it's really been a pleasure to talk with you. Muchas gracias.
Oh, gracias. And I hope everyone comes out and watches us perform.
A short chariot ride down the street from Eastern High School is Lansing's grandest building, the Michigan State Capitol. With its neoclassic Greco-Roman colonnades, it's not hard to imagine it's the Praetorium, the sprawling palace in Jerusalem to which Jesus was brought to face Pontius Pilate. That's where I met Arnold Hennig, a gray-bearded and soft-spoken man who's organizing this year's Passion Play.
What will happen at noon on Good Friday on these steps? And I think that the steps of the Capitol was probably a pretty good place in Lansing to begin the narrative of the Passion of Jesus Christ.
It is. We begin up here with the representation of Jesus' trial before Pilate and the public. And from there, the Stations of the Cross is a series of meditations on Jesus' path from his trial before Pilate to his death on the cross and his burial.
What are some of the physical landmarks here in Lansing that represent the stations?
We start here, stop across the street, we'll stop again at the clock, and then go down to the corner of Larch by the ballpark. And from there we proceed up Larch Street to Grand River with stops at Ellis Cleaning, at the American Eagle store, and at the corner of what was Papa Gio's Pizza, which is currently vacant. Then we go around and have one more stop on our way up to the Cristo Rey Center at High Street.
Arnold, what's your favorite part, or maybe least favorite part, of organizing all of this? What's rewarding or not so much so?
My least favorite part, I am not an organizer by nature. And there are a lot of things just have to be done by a certain amount of time. And you have to get a lot of people involved. I love working with the people once they're down here and working on the thing. I put a lot of time into redoing the scripts that we use, and bringing the scriptural references together with the way we express them is a marvelous thing. But the most marvelous thing is the work of the Holy Spirit on the day we're here. Because you come in with so many doubts, you're depending on so many people that you have no control of, and it falls together. And there is always something to be learned by each person here. Somebody expresses something that gives you a reason to think again. It's a marvelous thing.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And Friday's Stations of the Cross reenactment begins at the state capitol at noon. I'm Mark Bayshore. Flute virtuoso Sir James Galway has delighted classical music listeners for a half century. Sir James' legacy tour comes to East Lansing's Wharton Center for Performing Arts tomorrow night. WKAR's Peter Wharf caught up with the man with the golden flute earlier this week. Sir James Galway opened the conversation by describing some of the music and the players coming up at the Wharton Center.
The group consists of a string quintet and piano. And in the first half, we will do a Mozart quartet, followed by a piece by Debussy, and then a piece with my wife, Variations on Rigoletto by the Doppler brothers. And I will then finish the first half with Carmen. Second half, I will play two pieces that I used to play when I was a kid. And then we get into playing a piece by Hamilton Hardy called In Ireland, followed by three Irish folk song arrangements. And also we finish with playing Shenandoah and Danny Boy and a few things like that.
To celebrate your legacy of performance and your commitment to flute players all over the world, you've collaborated with Con Selmer in the development of a new high-quality student instrument. We have a big community of wind-playing students here who may want to know about if they're just entering.
Yeah, it's a student model flute, and I think for the money it's pretty good. It has a good head joint on it, designed by me, and suggested by me, that is. What they do with the suggestion is something else. But I think it's a pretty good deal. If people go to jamesgalway.com, they'll be able to log in on Facebook, and they'll be able to go to another place where I write a blog and where I also write about flute playing. There's a lot of things that they can do on there. But there's another thing I'd like to tell you about.
Yes.
And the listeners might want to know this. Recently, I made a 15-part series on how to play the flute. This begins with getting it out of the box. And we're going to try and put that out this coming September. And it will be it'll be for sale on the internet, and it will have subtitles, Korean, English, Korean, English, Korean, for the people who don't understand what I'm talking about, and Chinese and Japanese and Norwegian and all that sort of stuff.
I'm a string player, so I don't know a lot about flute basics, but what are some of the challenges that are most difficult to overcome, let's say, for a beginning flute player?
Here's what the problem is. The problem is there's not a real great, strong school of flute playing. Hmm. There's not a school which teaches you how to get the flute out of the box, for example. People just open the box and stick it together in any old way. There's a definite way of doing this, the same as when you take your violin out of the case.
Yes.
You clean it, dust it down, get it in tune, and you get ready to play. But the flute, they just take it out, stick it together, and play. And the position of the hands is important. The position of the body is important for the support, you know. You know, when you play the violin, it's much better standing up, isn't it?
It is.
Because you can get a good support.
That's exactly right, because you're able to sort of breathe and move more freely.
Yeah, that's correct. And you see, we get a better support with a good posture. People don't teach these sort of things, and then they wonder why they're not so successful. They wonder why the tone doesn't carry, why it doesn't get out there. And I can teach them how to do all these things. But, you know, it's a very hard thing, the beginners in school, because, you know, you get a poor guy who's a bandmaster, and maybe he's a clarinet player, and maybe he plays a little bit the French horn. So he knows a fingering for all these things. But the flute, well, he had a lesson on the flute once.
Right.
And he does his best. But I would like to sort of be able to influence these people. I would like to give a course to bandmasters about flute playing. It wouldn't take long, you know, about an hour and a half, and they would get the principle of the whole thing, and they would be able to do it better.
You're so busy on the stage and in so many areas of your musical life. What do you like to do when you're not making music?
Oh, Peter, I'm trying to play chess. I'm trying to improve my chess playing, and I keep getting beaten like a dog.
When did you become interested in chess? Have you always been interested?
Well, I was, as a kid, I was interested in it, but I didn't have anybody to guide me, so I just literally knew the moves. But then about 2 years ago, I got into playing it, and I found that I could do rather well against the people I was playing with. But unfortunately, they got better than me. You know, I used to be able to beat all my kids. Now they can all beat me, guaranteed. Thank you for your sympathy.
I sympathize with having children who surpass you or surpass me in many areas. James Galway performs at the Wharton Center for Performing Arts Thursday night here in East Lansing. Sir James, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter. Looking forward to it.
For Current State, this is Peter Wolf.
We're doing something a little different on Current State today. You may have heard the Beatles tribute band Rain is performing tomorrow night at 8 o'clock at the Wharton Center here at Michigan State. We have a pair of tickets to give away for that performance. To the first caller, please call 432-3305 to receive your pair of tickets to the Beatles tribute band Rain. 432-3305, our area code is 517. Coming up Thursday on Current State, we'll preview the Michigan State and Michigan Sweet 16 games with the Free Press's Joe Rexroad. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. Our Current State producer is Joe Lindstroth. Thanks to Aaron Young for engineering and to Sonia Treeweiler for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.